This message comes from OnPoint's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing Rate Shield Approval. If you qualify, and if rates go up, your rate stays the same. But if rates go down, your rate also drops. To learn more, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. On June 25th, 1973, Richard Nixon's former White House counsel, John Dean, testified before the Senate Watergate Committee. Dean himself had helped cover up the Watergate break-in, but he'd flipped on Nixon, and his testimony riveted the nation.
I began by telling the president that there was a cancer growing on the presidency, and that if the cancer was not removed, the president himself would be killed by it.
Well, that history was very much on stage again this month at Judge Brett Kavanaugh's Supreme Court confirmation hearings. John Dean testified about executive power. And listen to what Connecticut Democratic Senator Richard Blumenthal asks him.
There is now, arguably, a cancer on the presidency as malignant and metastasizing as there was then, correct?
Yes, I would agree with that.
Well, many people would disagree. John Dean cooperated in the Watergate investigation, but he was also disbarred, served 4 months, and reemerged in the eyes of some of his critics as a, quote, cult hero of the left. This hour on Point, we'll talk with John Dean himself about his views of executive power and the echoes of Watergate. You can join us. What is your question for John Dean? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. And a little later this hour, we're going to talk with medical personnel who can't evacuate as they wait for Hurricane Florence to make landfall on the East Coast. That'll be a little bit later in the show. But joining me now from Los Angeles is John Dean. Once again, he's former White House counsel for President Richard Nixon. He was a key witness for the prosecution in the Watergate hearings, and he joins us from Los Angeles. John Dean, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Magnus.
Well, it's great to have you. And first, let me just get right to it. That moment that Senator Blumenthal asked you about a cancer on the presidency, do you really think that such a cancer exists now in Washington?
It is similar. There are lots of echoes of Watergate occurring again. It was actually his later question when he asked me to compare Richard Nixon and Donald Trump. And I said, well, I see the core difference is that I think at bottom, Richard Nixon respected the law and believed in the rule of law. I'm not sure the incumbent president does.
But arguably then that would make what we're experiencing now worse.
Yes, I would. I've actually already used the title worse than Watergate in a book about the Bush administration. And when Bush and Cheney went to torture, that was a new low to me. And that's how the title of that book evolved.
But let me ask you, though, I mean, many people would disagree with you and say, well, President Trump, as of yet, I mean, there's an investigation going on for sure. But nothing coming out of Robert Mueller's investigation thus far has implemented the president himself directly, save for what Michael Cohen asserts. So, you know, while we know that Richard Nixon did indeed commit or participate in some crimes, we cannot say that yet of President Trump.
Well, I've been watching the Trump administration since day one, and if they've shown any signs that they're innocent about collusion, their connection with the Russian government, they're hiding it well. There's just no signs. They're acting like guilty people. This trying to attack the Department of Justice and the FBI, to undercut them, it just isn't an innocent person. I'm 30 chapters into Woodward's 42-chapter book, and I don't see any signs in that book either that they are innocent.
John Dean, you have been in the news both, you know, but doing interviews like this one, but also because your name keeps getting invoked. I wonder, you know, what you thought when President Donald Trump, in a tweet not that long ago, described Don McGahn, right, his White House counsel now, as a John Dean-type rat.
He said he was not.
He was.
And it shows a couple things. First of all, they don't really understand what happened with Watergate. It's a long time ago. Memories have faded. People don't really study that history. I technically really didn't flip either. I internally tried to get Nixon to end the cover-up in that so-called cancer on the presidency conversation. I raised every problem with an hour and 50-minute conversation. I didn't know it was taped at the time. I later suspected I had been taped in one or more conversations, and of course, that was correct. We have an amazing record of that history now. But you'll see me working internally to try to get him to stop the cover-up, and when I'm unable to do that is when I break rank.
So tell us, I mean, I'm glad you point that out, because we're at a phase where many people obviously still living remember that time around Watergate, and some don't as clearly. So take us back. I mean, at what point in time, if you say you didn't flip, then, you know, take us back to the chain of events that led you to the Watergate committee hearing in 1973.
Well, there were sort of three phases. Initially, I thought I could help my colleagues who were in a whole heap of trouble. I was unaware of the fact that they had broken in high-level authorization, set up a special unit to investigate leaks. The president directly set this up through his former White House counsel, John Ehrlichman. They, along the way, decided in chasing leaks, when they learned that Daniel Ellsberg had leaked the so-called Pentagon Papers, they broke into Daniel Ellsberg's psychiatrist's office to try to find out what all they could to discredit Ellsberg. The same people who were used in the Ellsberg break-in were later used in the Watergate break-in. I learned that 2 days after the arrest at the Watergate, when Gordon Liddy, one of the organizers and directors of the Watergate undertaking, as well as the Ellsberg, told me that two of the men that he'd used earlier while working at the White House were now in the D.C. jail. That was the motivation for Ehrlichman's cover-up of Watergate. I know also from the tapes and doing a book where I transcribed about 1,000 Nixon secret tapes, taped conversations, what his motive was. He was worried that his attorney general had approved this, and he really thought John Mitchell, his attorney general, was responsible for him being president. So it's out of worry about that. Haldeman, the chief of staff, he's just generally worried about this thing coming out and being reflecting poorly on the White House. There's no real organized meeting where people sit down and say, now how do we obstruct justice or anything like that. The obstruction of justice is a very fuzzy crime. It's not a bright line crime, and it's very easy to cross that line and get across it. And that's what happened. I, after the election, the break-in and arrest occur in June of 1973. After the election, I realized we're on the wrong side of the law. And that's my initial reaction is, my God, we've got to get this corrected. But my second reaction is, we've got to make this cover-up work. We just can't. We're all in trouble. And that's when I did the foolish things like destroying documents that showed Ehrlichman's role in the Ellsberg break-in and what have you, and did that until one of the original Watergate burglary team starts pressing me for money to remain silent. And that's when I went to Nixon and said, listen, this is going to go on indefinitely. These people are going to want more money. He says, how much? I said, I don't know. It could cost $1 million. That's about $5.5 million today.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was unable to convince him how much trouble we were in, I knew we were in trouble. And that's when I broke rank.
Yeah. Well, we're talking with John Dean. He's former White House counsel for President Richard Nixon. He served in that post from 1970 to 1973 and, of course, testified before the Senate Watergate Commission as well. And he's speaking out now a lot about what he sees in Washington and the Trump administration. And I want to know what your question for John Dean is. And actually, let's go to a call right now. Bill is calling from New London, Connecticut. You're on the air, Bill.
Hey, John, you've done a great service to America, and we really appreciate it. I wish somebody would step up and stop these racketeers that are in the White House now, stop this Supreme Court nomination. The guy's a crook. I really would love to, first of all, just to thank you, but also to ask you, how do the American people prevent this kind of fascism from emerging and the racism that's emerging? What do you think?
Well, I think it certainly starts in November, where a message has got to be sent to the president that enough. There's got to be a check on his presidency. The Republican-controlled Congress has no inclination to do anything on oversight or telling him he's gone astray. And I think that's where it's got to start. If it doesn't, we're in real trouble.
Mm. John Dean, how much do you, I mean, this is something that I think people have been thinking about a lot, but how much do you see the effect that Watergate and President Nixon had on America's trust in the office of the presidency itself? How much do you see that as reflecting on how people view the office today?
I never thought after Watergate we would ever have anything close to it. We had something following Watergate for about a decade called post-Watergate morality, which was a higher standard, Watergate being sort of the low mark as to what was acceptable to the American people. But that slowly began to erode. And the only really lasting impact of Watergate has been one on the media and two on the legal profession. And the media, presidents before Watergate were given the benefit of the doubt. When Eisenhower said, oh, that U-2 plane, it was just a weather plane, we weren't doing any spying. Well, he was given the benefit of the doubt until Gary Powers came out in the pilot and said, oh, no, I was spying.
Yeah.
Admitted he was spying.
Well, let me just take it right from you there, John Dean, for a second, because we have to take a quick break. We're speaking with John Dean. He's joining us today from Los Angeles. He is former White House counsel for President Richard Nixon. He was in that post from 1970 to 1973. What's your question for John Dean? He knows a lot about executive power and its discontents. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from On Point's sponsor, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, introducing their all-new Rate Shield approval. If you're in the market to buy a home, Quicken Loans will lock your rate for up to 90 days while you shop. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Rate Shield approval only valid on certain 30-year purchase transactions. Additional conditions or exclusions may apply, based on Quicken Loans data in comparison to public data records. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLS ConsumerAccess.org number 3030.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with John Dean. He's former White House counsel for President Richard Nixon from 1970 to 1973. And he was obviously a key witness in the Senate's Watergate hearings as well at that time. We're talking about executive power and its limits. Now, John Dean, before in that last segment, you talked about that you were reading Bob Woodward's new book, Fear. Well, in an interview with Nora O'Donnell of CBS This Morning today, FBI Director Christopher Wray actually refuted some of the claims that Woodward makes in his book, specifically that there's a breakdown of executive power going on. Here's their exchange.
In that book, he describes an administration, which you are part of, but he's specifically describing the White House as having a nervous breakdown of executive power. Have you experienced any of that?
I have not seen a nervous breakdown of executive power. I have also not read Mr. Woodward's book, and I'm not sure whether I'll ever find time.
Well, that's FBI Director Christopher Wray on CBS This Morning. John Dean, there's the FBI saying that, Wray at least, saying he hasn't seen a breakdown, a nervous breakdown of executive power. What do you think?
Well, I'm not exactly sure what Bob is talking about with a nervous breakdown with executive power. There certainly is chaos in the White House. There certainly is a president who's unwilling to become familiar with issues before he makes decisions. There's certainly a president who flips around and makes different decisions. There is a lot of petty infighting in this White House. not all the jobs are filled. If that's a nervous breakdown, okay, that's a nervous breakdown. It's not a well-oiled machine that Trump talks about.
Well, let's take a call here. John is calling from Enid, Oklahoma. You're on the air, John.
Yes. My question is, do you think our Congress is really enabling this president? If Nixon would have had our Congress that we have now, do you think he would have ever been where he ended up, you know, basically impeached?
Oh, so question. Yeah, John. So you're asking about since it seems as if Congress right now is, or at least part of Congress, isn't willing to really engage with President Trump on in the way that Congress did with President Nixon. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, that's okay. Very true.
Okay,
I mean that's what I see.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your call, John Dean. What do you think?
Well, the Congress is composed in a different way today. The Southern Democrats of Nixon's Congress are today Republicans. He was counting on Republicans and Southern Democrats to block his impeachment. What happened, though, is slowly but steadily, particularly when George Wallace wouldn't support him, he lost that support. The reason he resigned, it happened after the House impeachment inquiry had been launched, and they were voting on articles of impeachment. That's when several Republican members of the Senate went down to tell him, you don't have the votes in the Senate. In other words, it takes a simple majority of the House to impeach. To find guilty and remove from office, two different votes, it takes two-thirds of the Senate, or 67 senators. Actually, it took more back then. It was 67 votes. That's right. I was thinking of the cloture rule.
Yeah.
But he was told clearly he didn't have the support. Now, this didn't happen quickly. In the span of Watergate versus what's happening right now, we're very early, and it took a while for the public to understand what was going on. The Senate Watergate hearings, the House impeachment inquiry, they were televised, and people began to get a larger picture, and that's when Nixon's support began to erode. Today, there's really been very little public exposure of what's going on. Books, yes. Newspaper articles, yes. But not the really massive media coverage that happened in Watergate.
Well, I mean, isn't that part because there aren't certain congressional hearings going on when there could be.
There are no congressional hearings going on other than the Senate and House Intelligence Committees, which are all behind closed doors. Now, I suspect if the House becomes controlled by the Democrats and the Senate, we're going to have some public hearings.
Yeah, but John D., let me ask you a question, though, because, I mean, we started this conversation in the last segment really talking about your view of executive power. And one thing that's come up repeatedly, a theme that's come up repeatedly over the past several weeks on this show is that, the one true check or one of the true checks to executive power is the legislative branch. But, you know, even in the wake of that anonymous op-ed from a senior White House official that we had in the New York Times not that long ago, I mean, congressional leaders like House Speaker Paul Ryan were saying, well, I'm just focusing on what we're getting accomplished. So for as long as one party believes they're getting a lot of accomplished, what incentive do they have to serve as
a check? Well, I see very little getting accomplished by the House or Senate.
Well, the GOP would say that they are getting a lot accomplished.
Well,
they
got the tax cut through for the corporate and big donor clients that help support the Republican Party, but very, very little else. They have not had any oversight hearings whatsoever, and that's just as important a function of the of the Congress as is making law, is checking the other branches of government. So we have had none of that.
Yeah.
They spent years on Benghazi and Hillary's emails. They want to have new investigations of Hillary's emails. She hasn't been in office in 5 years, but they still want to start hearings on that. Well, that's not going to happen. I think that the Congress is going to change control in November.
Well, so, I mean, do you think the bigger issue is the expansion of executive power or the retraction of legislative oversight?
I think it right now it's a retraction of oversight. What happened is executive power has always stayed about the same or increased. Even post-Watergate, it didn't really lose its power. What happened is Congress started exercising its powers and performing the check function that the founders envisioned. That hadn't happened before. So when all the branches are operating as envisioned, that's when you have the healthiest government.
We're talking with John Dean today, and Bethany's got a question. She's calling from Charlottesville, Virginia. You're on the air, Bethany.
Hi. Yes, this is Bethany. My question is regarding the New York Times op-ed. Dean commented that he had multiple times tried to change Nixon's mind, and it reminds me of the idea of, like, needing good people in difficult situations. I was wondering what his take on the anonymous op-ed is.
All right. Stephanie, thank you so much for your call. John Dean, your response?
Good question, and a lot of attention has focused on the mystery of who wrote it. I would hope the president would focus on what it says. If he was running a smooth White House, if he was showing the kind of leadership that needs to be in the Oval Office, a disgruntled person or group of people, whichever it might be that did the op-ed, would not be sending an op-ed like that to the New York Times, nor would they have talked to Woodward. Very similar material, lots of disgruntled employees because there's no leadership.
John Dean, though, can I just jump in here for a second? I mean, yes, people perhaps are too focused on who wrote it. But, I mean, this is a question I really want to ask you. You came forward, right? You sat, stated your name on the record in front of the Senate and gave, you know, you read a statement, your opening statement to the Watergate Commission was more than 200 pages long. I think a lot of people are wondering, well, if folks inside the Trump administration are so worried now, why don't they do the same thing?
There's no forum at this point. They can talk to, you know, if they've been called to the grand jury, they could theoretically talk there. You've got to remember that my Senate testimony was just a sort of a second phase. I had originally gone and spoken with the U.S. assistant U.S. attorneys handling the Watergate investigation. I broke off relationships with them when I realized they couldn't handle it. They started reporting back to the. I'd gone to them on the condition they not report back to Maine Justice because I said if it goes there, it'll go back to the White House. Well, they broke that promise very quickly, and that's when I stopped dealing with them because that's exactly what did happen. We have tapes, hours and hours of Nixon talking to the head of the criminal division, and that's when they set up sort of the unwritten rule that the Department of Justice was to be independent, to be isolated, and only White House counsel was to talk to the people in the Department of Justice.
Yeah. But so, I mean, if there's no structure now, though, couldn't the structure be the byline of the op-ed pages of the New York Times? Like putting your name, not you, obviously, but whoever wrote it, putting their name on it. If that has to be where the structure exists, then so be it.
It would seem that these people, this person or people, think that they are actually doing more good right now by staying in their job and protecting the people from the president, rather than revealing themselves and leaving.
Do you think they're doing more good?
Well, after having read as much of the Woodward book as I have read, it's pretty frightening in there. This is a man who is totally incompetent to be president. He's unprepared for the job. He doesn't study in the job. He doesn't work in the job. He doesn't come down to the office some days until 11:30. He watches Fox News. That's where he gets his intelligence. I mean, we've just never had anything like this.
Yeah. Well, let's go to another caller here. John is calling from Detroit, Michigan. You're on the air, John.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Mr. Dean, just had a quick question. I mean, I'll be honest, I'm only 37 years old, so I wasn't around for Watergate. But I know around that time, because of Watergate, the American people kind of lost faith a little bit in the system, a little bit in their government, kind of questioned more. So my question is, if we see another Watergate situation or some situation where the president is found to have abused his power, you know, what do you think the fallout from that could be, especially given the current climate as it already is?
Good question, John. It will hurt the government. It'll hurt the office of the president. What really, I looked at the polling pre and post Watergate, and what was interesting is it was the lies, to put it bluntly, that had come out about Vietnam and the war in Vietnam and how we were doing, why we were still there. That hurt the presidency more than Watergate did. But it was already driven down by that. Watergate nudged it a little bit further, and there was a loss of trust in government as a result of that. Yeah. That's not healthy. We really need to believe in our system, and it had come back post-Watergate, but this will hurt it again.
Let's go to Emily, who's calling from Cape Elizabeth, Maine. You're on the air, Emily.
Hi, thanks so much for taking my call. My question is actually about the differences between Trump and Nixon rather than the similarities. I'm struck by how they're similar in that both acted undemocratically in a campaign sense and, you know, the partisan sense, Democrats, Republicans. But the major difference to me seems to be that Nixon at least had the political experience and the political motivation to act in America's best interest, whereas Trump right now is pursuing policies that are, some would argue are thwarting American interests. Is that difference important? Does it make a difference at all in how Congress or the special counsel should pursue their investigation? Right now, they're just looking at it from an election standpoint, but do you see it moving more into a policy standpoint as well?
Emily, thanks for your call.
Good observations. I think you're absolutely right. Nixon had been a member of the House, member of the Senate. He'd been vice president. He'd actually been acting president before he ran for office and succeeded. He was very knowledgeable about government. He had studied law. He'd argued cases in front of the Supreme Court. Our current president thinks that Supreme Court justices sign bills, which they do not. He wants the Chief Justice to run an investigation of the Russia inquiry. I mean, he just has no conception of how government really works. I don't know if that's affecting the special counsel's investigation. I think Mueller is just looking at what's happened. It is a twofold investigation. It is a counterintelligence investigation to understand what the Russians did and how they did it, as well as it's got some criminal inquiry. His mandate says that if he finds crimes in looking at what happened with the Russians, that he should pursue those. That's what happened to Paul Manafort, who's about to go on his second trial.
Yeah. John Dean, forgive me for interrupting you, but there's another caller that I want to get to before we run out of time with you. Mike is calling from Atlanta, Georgia. You're on the air, Mike.
What's that again?
Hey, Mike, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. My question for Mr. Dean is, when you took your job at the White House, did you consider yourself to be a Nixon loyalist? That is, we're beyond your professional responsibility. Did you feel like, on a political and personal level, you trusted him? At what point did you find that that trust was betrayed? And how did that feel? Do you remember that moment? And if so, how do you think that relates to people currently working in the White House?
I was not sure about Nixon before I went over. I had, in fact, my boss, immediate boss, the Deputy Attorney General, advised me not to take the job. The Attorney General, John Mitchell, said, don't take the job. But at my age, I was in my early 30s, they said, we understand why you'd want that on your resume. So I went over, and I really didn't start dealing with Nixon until I'd been there almost 2.5 years. Almost 8 months after the arrest at the Watergate is when he starts calling on me. That's when all my taped conversations take place with him. About almost 40 conversations that are recorded. I believed in him. I didn't know what he knew and what he didn't know. I was very gentle in dealing with it, the situation. But it's by the time I go in to tell him there's a cancer on the presidency, to get him to blow up the cover-up, That's the day I really think I met him, and I was really surprised that he reacted in that conversation the way he did. So it was the day I met Richard Nixon. After that, I realized I couldn't do anything, and the best thing I could do was go to the grand jury and start the unraveling process. That was behind closed doors. Grand juries are not, they're secret, and they remain secret indefinitely. And I thought that was a way to unravel the Watergate. But when the prosecutors couldn't handle it, I realized the Senate was the only place to go.
Well, John Dean, former White House counsel for President Richard Nixon, joining us today from Los Angeles. And now we've got to let you go. This was absolutely a fascinating conversation, Mr. Dean. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit more about Hurricane Florence and medical centers getting ready for the big storm. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.
This message comes from NPR's sponsor, Indeed. When it comes to hiring, you don't have time to waste. You need help getting to your short list of qualified candidates fast. With Indeed, post a job in minutes, set up screener questions, then zero in on qualified candidates. And when you need to hire fast, accelerate your results with sponsored jobs. New users can try for free when you sign up at Indeed.com/NPR podcast. Terms, conditions, and quality standards apply.
Planet Money tip number 17. Sometimes the most important things need a hype squad.
Corporate. Income.
Income.
Tax.
Corporate income tax!
Planet Money, a podcast about the economy. A very enthusiastic podcast about the economy.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
Once this storm is upon us, we're not going to be able to send emergency personnel out
right.
to save you or to help you. You have to heed those warnings, get out of harm's way before this storm takes place, and just ride this thing out.
Well, voices there from the Carolinas as hospitals in the region are preparing for the arrival of Hurricane Florence. Some medical facilities and nursing homes in the direct path of the hurricane are moving patients inland. Other medical personnel are staying put and staying open in their role as first responders in what's expected to be a powerful and devastating storm. So I'm wondering if you are in the path of Hurricane Florence and if you are evacuating or have chosen to stay put. And has a loved one been moved from a coastline hospital? Do you know where they've been moved to? And how is it that after Hurricane Harvey and Hurricane Katrina and all the big storms that we've had, what have we learned about how to keep key medical centers up and running through the storm and the recovery period? Well, joining us first right now is Matt Wayne. He's with us from Charleston, South Carolina. He's Chief Operations Officer at Medical University of South Carolina Health. Matt Wayne, welcome to On Point.
Meghna, it's great to be here.
How are you guys doing right now?
We're doing great. There's a lot of great preparation that's going on. We're really positioned to succeed. The team here at MUSC has a tremendous amount of experience with hurricanes and hurricane preparation, and really our focus continues to be, as it should, on being ready to take care of patients and families throughout South Carolina, or as a way of receiving patients from other communities that are equally or more so devastated by the onset of Hurricane Florence.
Yeah. So can you tell us a little bit about where the facility is located? Are you guys in a low-lying area? I mean, what's the thing that you're most concerned about in order to your ability to stay open as the storm progresses?
The majority of our facilities are in downtown Charleston, so we're right on the peninsula and immediately on the coast. And so while there are several models and there are variabilities to them with this storm, in most cases, we are expected to see a significant impact from Hurricane Florence and are preparing and planning in earnest for that.
Okay. And so, but what are the impacts that you're worrying about? Because I remember, you know, from Katrina, for example, we had some pretty terrible stories there of hospitals, you know, getting flooded, generators being knocked out. So, of course, generators and, well, electricity powers so many key, literally life-saving instruments in a hospital. So what's your area of greatest concern?
I think right now it's the uncertainty of what the storm's going to do. And at
right.
the same time, we can't worry about that. We can only worry about the preparation and planning that will make us successful in taking care of patients who trust their care to us. and those patients and families that are disrupted by the storm and need us when they haven't in the past. And so in order to do that, we've been planning in earnest over the weekend, throughout the week. We've got about a week and a half worth of all significant supplies on hand. We have extra diesel fuel to be able to run sustained operations in the event of a power loss for several days. We've really got a lot of preparedness here, and our ability to control those things that we can control, the weather not one of them, we are ready, and people throughout South Carolina should know they can trust MUSC Health if they need us.
Yeah, so, and how many beds do you have there?
We're a facility of over 800 beds, and we run four unique hospitals in downtown Charleston.
And is the center expected to stay open through the entire storm?
We are. MUSC Health is the only academic medical center in the state of South Carolina, and as such, we've been afforded an exemption to the medical evacuation order. So we're here to take care of those patients and families that otherwise may not have appropriate care available to them. We've already seen an influx of patients from hospitals that are closing or who are more in the line of the storm in the Myrtle Beach area. And so we've continued to look to be able to serve the citizens of South Carolina and are ready, if necessary, to serve the citizens of North Carolina as well.
Yeah, so really, really important medical center there, obviously, and for the whole state. Does that mean that is the entire hospital staff, all personnel, going to be expected to be at work through the storm? And, you know, obviously people may not be able to go home. How are you managing, taking care of employees?
Yeah, that's a very good question because we focus on patients, but at the end of the day, it's our care team members who make that possible. They're the strength of our organization. And so we have communicated with them. We run every 4 hours. We have an open conference call with any member of our care team who would like to listen in to the decisions and why we're making them. We provide around-the-clock communications in terms of email, social messaging, an alert system through text. And so we've got a large number of our staff and our providers in-house. They all, without a problem, commit to being here. Charleston, we've learned a lot in the last few years, for us specifically, from Hurricanes Matthew and Irma, and have made adjustments in order to better take care of our care team members. We set up R&R areas, if you will. We turn amphitheaters and conference rooms into a movie house. We run our wellness center and open that up. We have sleeping accommodations. And so we get to the point where it's not just about taking care of patients. It's really about taking care of our care team as well so that we can be rest assured our patients received the best care that's highly reliable and safe.
Yeah. Well, Matt Wayne, stand by for just a second. That's Matt Wayne. He's joining us from Charleston, South Carolina. He's Chief Operations Officer at Medical University of South Carolina Health. And we are talking about, the really important health care infrastructure that also has to weather whatever Hurricane Florence is going to bring. And as Matt Wayne said, they have to get an exemption from the mandatory evacuation orders in order to keep this key hospital open. So Matt, hang on here for just a second, because let's go to Houston, Texas now. Douglas Brinkley joins us. He's a presidential historian and professor of history at Rice University. He was a professor at Tulane University in New Orleans when Hurricane Katrina hit in 2005, and he's author of the book The Great Deluge, Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans, and the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Douglas Brinkley, welcome back to On Point.
Well, thanks for having me on, Megan.
It's great to have you. Matt Wayne there said very clearly that their multiple experiences with hurricanes has led to a lot of learning at Medical University of South Carolina. And I just wanted to talk with you because that's a good thing, because we've had, Katrina was the example of how we had medical failures as well. And I just to remind folks, I was going back and reading stories about Memorial Medical Center in Uptown New Orleans and the disasters that happened there.
Well, look, the big thing, when we talk about the deadliest storm in U.S. history on record, it occurred in 1900 near where I'm at in Houston, in Galveston, Texas, and over 6,000 people died in Galveston. Why so many dead in Galveston? Well, in 1900, we didn't have forecasting, so people failed to evacuate. there's no excuse at this point in the 21st century for people to be hearing how devastating things are going to be on North Carolina, not to get out, not to evacuate. And we'll be judging the people there in North Carolina of how did they do with their less, you know, the people on lower economic scale, people that didn't have automobiles to drive away. Was there mass transportation that takes people away? Many older seniors don't want to leave their dog or cat. Are there evacuation services that allow you to bring pets with you? On and on. But the big medical challenge, as I see it, is the blackout. When you lose electricity for 48 hours, you start getting unnecessary death. People will die that, you know, that were supposed to be on a dialysis machine, people that need their respirator, the people that can't find their medication in the darkness, or the floodwaters wash your medications away. You have people that will die of heart attacks and strokes from the stress of it all. So it's very important to try to get out, number one, and number two, to make sure the local medical infrastructure knows where those people that are staying are and try to get to them within 48 hours.
Yeah. Matt Wayne, let me just turn back to you for a second, because what Douglas Brinkley said just got me thinking. I mean, obviously there are patients with different levels of need, some of whom maybe could be evacuated. Have you relocated some patients?
Of course. We want to minimize our census to only what's medically necessary here. We want, and our primary goal is to keep people safe. And so we've been working all week to make sure that we can get people discharged when medically appropriate and either home or into a place that's safe. Additionally, I think he makes some great points. And so, you know, with just on a couple of things where we've learned, right, we contact all of our patients who are on dialysis and remind them to make sure batteries are in order. If they need to come in and get checkups early and get the things they need, we accommodate them. We open our retail pharmacies to the community so that we can make sure people have meds. We've made virtual care. We can do virtual urgent care for no charge for any citizen in South Carolina who doesn't have access to care, so that if they have a question, we can answer it, and if necessary, we can provide them with a face-to-face with a provider. We acquired a light medium tactical vehicle that will drive through, you know, up to 6 to 8 feet of water, because Charleston's known to flood. And one of the things we learned when we had to transport a surgeon between two of our hospitals by boat the last time was that that's not the best way to make sure that you've got care providers in the right place. And so we literally have an LMTV, which we acquired as military surplus, that we've painted and put to work in good use. And so we're ready. I'm sure there's things that we will learn from this as well, but I'd like to think that we've done.
Can I just jump in here, Matt? I'm so sorry to interrupt, but LMTV, it's a retired military vehicle.
Yeah, it's a light medium tactical vehicle. It's literally a vehicle that's formerly used by the military. There's a 1033 program that's available to first responders, and we were able to acquire it. And so we can move staff from building to building. We can get critical supplies. If we need to get plasma to facilities because for some reason we're running through it faster in one of our locations than another, if there's a critical patient need, we can drive through some pretty deep water to ensure that we can get there safely.
Well, Douglas Brinkley, definitely sounds like Medical University of South Carolina is as ready as it could be. And that's obviously the right thing, because I mentioned Memorial Medical Center in New Orleans from post-Katrina. And I mean, that was the place where the hurricane did knock out power and the temperature soared to, you know, what, 100 degrees in the hospital. There was questions about the physicians perhaps maybe hastening the deaths of patients stuck in the hospital. There were 45 corpses in the mortuary. And then, of course, there was the stories of nursing homes that didn't evacuate when Katrina was on the way, and nursing home residents dying. So in the past, we have had terrible situations, and nobody wants that to happen again. Absolutely not.
Well, absolutely, and that's what happened in New Orleans. You picked on Memorial and Charity Hospital, which had all sorts of problems. However, there was an Ochsner Hospital that behaved in a miraculous fashion, working around the clock. The big thing is generators and energy. Can hospitals function? You made the key point that we need to learn from Katrina. A lot of people in assisted living facilities, we think they're being taken care of, but when the darkness comes, electricity's out, flooding comes, a lot of times those assisted living places get abandoned, and people will die because they're left behind there. Some of the failures of Katrina were doctors and nurses, and police for that matter, who just fled and said, I'm getting out of here, and let people die. I also, in my book, wrote about an incredible doctor who took AIDS patients that were very ill and found a way to get them airlifted out to San Antonio and wouldn't leave the patient's bedside. Yeah. One thing that's preventable for people that aren't sick or ill right now is don't go out in the high winds. I spoke to many doctors. I mean, metal flies around when winds are 140 miles an hour, and it's like shrapnel out there. And the number of people that needed stitches at hospitals because they went out in the winds to see what it would feel like, then got hit by an object.
Wow.
It's quite high, yeah. And what it does is it fills up the hospitals unnecessarily, so you don't want to do something boneheaded like going out to feel
yeah.
the wind.
So I hate to do this because I don't want to bring politics into this situation when we're talking about sort of the life and death of, decisions about being ready for a hurricane. But politics does just sort of barrel its way into things. And because, you know, just today, President Trump sent out a couple of tweets claiming, you know, 3,000 people did not die in the two hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico. That's from his tweet. And then he said that 3,000 estimate was done by Democrats in order to make me look as bad as possible when I was successfully raising billions of dollars to help rebuild Puerto Rico. Now, to be clear, that estimate of the number of deaths, 2,975, came from the island's governor itself, following a report from the George Washington University. So, Douglas Brinkley, I just want to know what your thoughts are that the president's putting out these tweets now as the Carolinas are getting ready to face Hurricane Florence.
Well, I think President Trump's making a terrible mistake. It's foolish to be behaving that way. It's filled with self-regard instead of really trying to be a leader through this kind of crisis. The idea that we couldn't have done better in Puerto Rico is ridiculous. I mean, 2,975 death toll when President Trump acted like it was, you know, a much, much lower number than that. That's okay. Maybe Donald Trump misspoke or if we didn't have the full count, but why not just embrace it now and say we will do better? He can't take self-criticism that Maria is seen as a failure of the Trump presidency, the slow reaction there, the inability to get people food and water quickly, the fact that it took power months to get on in some places. It wasn't given a high prioritization from this administration. I think Trump did better in Harvey in Texas. But Puerto Rico was treated like some kind of orphaned island that we didn't want to do our best with. And I think it's a sad, dark part of the Trump presidential legacy, the way that he is still speaking about the island and insulting people there.
Mm. Well, Matt Wayne, we've got 30 seconds left. I'm going to just trust that you're not worried about politics right now, but definitely staying focused on helping people there in South Carolina.
Our mission, simply put, is to optimize life. We are in a position, through preparation and planning, and having a fantastic care team here to be able to take care of the people throughout this state who might need us in an emergency. We can only control our planning and preparation. What people say, where the hurricane goes, is not anything we can control. We're ready, and I really appreciate you allowing us to share some of our preparations with your audience today.
Yeah, well, Matt Wayne, I very much appreciate your efforts in joining us today as well. Chief Operations Officer at Medical University of South Carolina, speaking to us from Charleston. Thank you so very much, Matt Wayne.
Thank you.
And Douglas Brinkley, presidential historian and professor of history at Rice University in Houston and author of The Great Deluge, Hurricane Katrina, New Orleans, and the Mississippi Gulf Coast. Douglas Brinkley, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so very much.
Thank you.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.